We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both formerly with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover as usual, starting with a couple November ballot initiatives.
Yeah. King County Court of Appeals ruled this week on the two preschool child care initiatives that are competing with each other on the November ballot. They ruled against the coalition Yes for Early Success, which petitioned the court to separate the two initiatives on the ballot so that they wouldn't compete with each other. And that group, Yes for Early Success, is backed by mostly by organized labor. Now, the judge, he sided with the city of Seattle, who grouped the two initiatives, saying that, yes, the two initiatives are related and that pitting them against each other on the ballot is required by state law. Now, Yes for Early Success says that they've conducted a poll recently showing that voters' support is stronger for the union-backed initiative, the one that would raise wages for child care workers to $15 an hour immediately and that would mandate training. The city's initiative, on the other hand, would expand preschool to low-income families. But, you know, it's still early, and a significant number of voters in that poll were undecided, about 25 to almost 30%. And that's enough voters to make it swing either way. So, yes, on November, we will be looking at a ballot that makes us choose between paying preschool and daycare teachers more versus expanding preschool and daycare to more low-income families. It's unfortunate, but that's what we'll see.
And, you know, the irony here is that this is the sort of thing that, in fact, legislators do all the time. They choose among priorities for limited budgets between what may be,
that's
you know,
true.
Two very good ideas. And that's been one of the criticisms of the initiative process, and particularly people like Tim Iman, is people are presented with a choice, you know, without any context of what other costs this is, you know, the opportunity costs and this sort of thing. But in this case, there is no real apparent need to pit these against each other. So it's unfortunate that we get this sort of false choice in this case. But in other cases, such as, we're going to forbid people from raising these taxes, but it doesn't give you any information on what kind of services will have to be sacrificed. People don't have that kind of information and don't have that context in which to make the choice.
All right. Speaking of Tim Iman, he's trolling for a new initiative.
Yeah. Tim Iman needs a job next year. This will actually be the the first time in his long and sordid initiative pimping career that Mr. Iman has not had an initiative on the ballot in 2014. And in fact, he didn't qualify one for the ballot either in 2013. The one that was on the ballot last year actually was qualified the previous year in 2012. So and some of his longtime backers are no longer available. Particularly Stephen Dunmire, the wealthy businessman who passed away earlier this year, who had financed a number of his initiatives. So he's looking for some new backers. And so he has latched on, as we've mentioned was reported last month, to the idea of a statewide initiative to ban local municipalities from raising the minimum wage higher than the state level. This was specifically aimed at Seattle, of course, and there was a group of Seattle businesses called Forward Seattle that attempted to qualify an initiative for the November ballot that would have challenged the local $15 an hour minimum wage initiative, and it failed spectacularly. They couldn't get enough They couldn't get enough signatures despite having plenty of time and paid signature gatherers and a good deal of money from some reactionary local businesses who wanted to try and stop the minimum wage initiative. Well, Mr. Iman looked at this and said, hey, there's some money there. People are willing to pour money into a completely failed initiative attempt. That sounds like something I could do, too. So he's been peddling what literally is a prospectus to different potential investors looking for $2.2 million, $1.1 for the signature gathering process, and then another $1.1 million for the actual campaign to try and run a statewide initiative which would forbid local municipalities from raising the minimum wage above what the statewide standard is. Now, we've seen this approach before in conservative circles. It is, for example, one of the reasons why we can't have rent control or other tenant landlord support laws. Seattle and some other cities like Tacoma had laws like that on the books in the past, and they were preempted by a statewide by a statewide measure that forbade municipalities from enacting measures tougher than the statewide standard. And so they're looking at doing that with this here. This coming from conservatives that are all about local control, except of course when the local control is about things that they don't like. So once again, Iman looking to try and qualify this. His track record on getting this done is not very good, however. So hopefully these savvy business people will take one look at him and say, this is not a winning investment.
All right. Moving on, the Washington State Supreme Court taking on education funding this week.
Yeah, the Washington Supreme Court held their special hearing on K-12 funding this week. It, in the wake of the McCleary decision in December 2012 that the legislature is in violation of the state's constitution by not adequately funding K-12 education in Washington State, which is specified in the Constitution. In 2013 and 2014, the legislature had the opportunity to enact some kind of education funding plan, and they didn't do it. They had opportunities to direct more money into current K through 12 funding programs, and they didn't do it. Except this last legislative session, they put about $1 billion in, but about half of that money was in one-time transfers that are not going to be ongoing. And so the Washington Supreme Court in June ruled that the legislature is at risk for being in contempt of court by not following through on the court's decision in December 2012 that the legislature must fund K-12 education. And so the state Supreme Court this week held their hearing as to they listened to arguments from the lawyers on both sides who made their arguments about why the legislature should or shouldn't have more time to come up with a funding plan. Now, the state Supreme Court really wasn't buying it. The justices really were not buying the arguments of the legislature's lawyers. They said, you know, you've had almost 2 years, you've had two legislative sessions, and nothing's come out of it. You know, if we give you more time, we're just basically saying we trust you and we don't care whether you follow our rulings or not. So the justices appeared to me like they're going to take the evidence from both lawyers, go and weigh the evidence, and probably come back with a ruling of the legislature being in contempt of court. Now, if they do that, they have to come up with some sanctions or punishments for the legislature. And there's a few things that they could do. For example, they could impose monetary sanctions. They could prohibit the legislature from funding other expenditures before K-12 education. They could order the legislature to pass specific legislation that would direct funding to the schools. They could order the sale of state property to fund schools. Or, and this is my favorite, they could automatically repeal all 600 of the tax breaks on the state's books and force the state legislature to reconsider each of those tax breaks one at a time at the same time as they're trying to come up with a school funding plan. That's my favorite, and I'm hoping that that's what they come up with.
Yeah, and unfortunately, what they cannot do, they can't mandate the legislature to pass particular laws that aren't already out there. They can mandate them to repeal existing laws, but not to pass new legislation.
Yeah, they could, for example, take a Democratic proposal from the last session and say that's what needs to be passed.
Yeah,
and mandate that.
But what's missing here, and what's missing from almost all the media coverage on this, is the reason that the legislature hasn't been able to pass any of this is you've got one portion of the legislature that's controlled by a party that is ideologically opposed to any revenue increases,
and for anything.
But you literally, and you know, setting aside the fact that they're defining the corporate loopholes as revenue increases, which is kind of insane. You literally, just as a matter of mathematics, you cannot adequately fund education in this state without raising revenue, because the tax structure of this state is such that it is guaranteed to shrink the revenue base of the state from year to year on the basis of inflation and rising costs, unless there are additional either tax increases or additional sources of revenue. And the legislature has been able to agree on any of those, because because you have one party that absolutely refuses to even consider them or compromise on them. This is what has held the legislature up, and this is what needs to be changed. And it's really very constitutionally dubious that the Supreme Court can force the legislature to do that. But that really is what needs to happen, because absent that, you're playing a shell game with inadequate revenues. You're forcing cuts potentially in other really essential services in order to fund this particular essential service.
Yeah, and to the people who say, the state gets adequate revenue, what are you talking about, Jav? He's really right, because so much of the state budget relies on fees that are a set amount that only change when the state legislature increases the fee structure, which, you know, does not happen often enough to keep revenues growing. And the other big parts of the state budget are the property tax, which doesn't always grow, as we've seen in the last 6 years since the economic downturn, which was spawned by a housing crisis that led to lower property values in large parts of the state. Maybe not so much in Seattle, but certainly in rural parts of the state. And also the state sales tax, which, when you've got a growing population of more and more kids in schools that need more and more money, the sales tax doesn't always keep up with that. So, yes, he's absolutely right. The revenues are not growing the way they need to.
All right, let's move on. DOJ is taking action in Ferguson, it appears.
Yeah, the Department of Justice decided this week that, yes, they're going to investigate the Ferguson Police Department and open a broad civil rights investigation into police practices in Ferguson, in the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department, including investigating potential racial profiling. This all arose from the shooting death of Michael Brown on August 9th, which is now almost a month old. And it's separate from the DOJ investigation specifically into Brown's death. The DOJ has refused to say whether it will expand this investigation to other St. Louis County police departments, even though locals in Ferguson and other folks in St. Louis County, particularly the NAACP, have requested that the Department of Justice look into other troubling incidents that they think were racially motivated. On the part of St. Louis County police departments. And then finally on Wednesday, the Ferguson police chief, Thomas Jackson, said that he does and will welcome the investigation, which is something, of course, that he should have said about 3 weeks ago if he really was wanting to stop the protests in Ferguson. He should have said that about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, and it's not like he has a choice.
No.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
All right. Developments this week with the Deepwater Horizon?
Yeah, there was a settlement in the case and also a court ruling in the Deepwater Horizon oil spill case. And I just want to remind folks that happened back in 2010. It was the largest oil spill in U.S. history when the Deepwater Horizon oil platform blew out in the Gulf of Mexico. On Wednesday, Halliburton settled with businesses, governments, and people living in the Gulf region affected by the spill. The settlement was $1.1 billion. Halliburton had already set aside about $1.3 billion, so of course their balance sheet is not going to take much of a hit from that settlement. Halliburton, of course, prepared the cement that was used in the well, which was a key factor in the blowout of the well. Now, the next day on Thursday, U.S. District Court Judge Carl J. Barbier, who is the judge in the case, ruled that BP was, quote, grossly negligent in the operation of the well, not just merely negligent as Halliburton and Transocean were, Transocean being the company that owned the majority share of the well. BP operated the well on Transocean's behalf, and Halliburton provided certain services in the construction and capping of the well. Now, BP acted with, quote unquote, conscious disregard of known risks, and its conduct was reckless, according to the judge. Its decisions were based not on following safety procedures or standard practices for a deep water well, but all decisions were, and this is another direct quote, primarily driven by a desire to save time and money rather than ensuring that the well was secure, end quote. Now, for being merely negligent, Transocean paid about $4.4 billion to settle criminal charges last year. Those are the owners of the well. BP paid $4 billion in federal criminal penalties. And, of course, Halliburton has just settled for $1.1 billion in their civil suit. But this is a civil suit against BP that we're talking about now. And the civil penalties could be up to $18 billion. BP has already spent about $28 billion in cleanup costs and damage claims. And to do that, they've had to sell a number of properties that they owned, oil wells, oil pipelines, et cetera. So BP's a smaller company already because of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. And the judge said in his ruling that BP was 67% to blame for the spill, Transocean about 30%, and Halliburton 3%. So it seems to me that BP is paying their 67% share.
Yeah, spectacularly negligent, actually. Mm-hmm. But yeah. The thing is, we saw with Exxon Valdez how these court cases
drag
on. And then in that case, the civil case findings against ExxonMobil, they managed to get those turned on appeal after 20 years. So even with the civil case dragging on, it may be a long, long time before the plaintiffs see any money, if ever, because it could be dragged on an appeal for many, many years to come.
Yeah,
this is how these companies operate.
BP has been very aggressive on this civil case in particular. Even though they settled and paid criminal charges and they've paid cleanup costs, they've been really pushing back on this case in particular.
And there's a reason for that, because this is not the only place in which they've been spectacularly negligent. They've operated that way globally as a matter of routine practice for a number of years, and are facing cases in a number of different parts of the globe, not as large as the Gulf of Mexico, but other incidences where they've been responsible for environmental degradation. And this also sets a modern precedent for other oil companies,
yes,
as well that are also concerned about this not becoming too costly.
All right, moving on. Federal Reserve study out this week.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve released its triannual, which means it releases it every 3 years, survey of consumer finances. Now, they looked at the period from 2010 to 2013 to see, what's the state of Americans' finances. And they found that the top 10% of Americans' average income rose 10% in that time period. That's the top 10% of the wealthiest Americans. Now, for the rest, incomes were flat or they declined. The biggest decline was for the bottom 20%, who had an 8% decline in incomes, and get this, a 21% decline in overall wealth, not what they make every year in income, but what assets they own, a 21% decline. But something else in the report pointed as to why the quote-unquote bright spot that some analysts pointed out is that debt levels have decreased all across the board, particularly in the lower 20% group. Only 8.2% of households paid more than 40% of their incomes in debt payments. That's the lowest in the past 15 years. But what that tells me is that the poor are working really, really hard, not making enough money. Their income is lower than is getting smaller and smaller, and they're paying all that money to pay off debts which are owned by rich people whose incomes are growing as partially as a result. That's what that picture tells me.
All right. Moving on, a couple lawmakers in Virginia having an interesting week.
Yeah, Bob McDonnell, who previously had presidential ambitions that were somewhat torpedoed by being an aggressive proponent of the transvaginal probe for potential abortion seekers in Virginia. That was the first state where that was
proposed.
It actually didn't pass there, although it has subsequently in a number of other states, particularly in the South. He had a bad week. He and his wife were convicted on a number of counts, corruption charges. He was convicted on 11 of 14, and his wife Maureen on 7. The legal tack they chose was kind of interesting. They had actually been offered a plea bargain, according to the Washington Post, post last year in which he would only plead guilty to one federal count and she would get off entirely. They chose not to do that and instead decided on a legal strategy where he would paint her as being the crazy, manipulative, greedy, reckless, verbally abusive spouse who was responsible for it all. This actually was their legal strategy, and both of them testified, and he brought in a number of other people to testify as to how horrible and controlling she was. And the jury didn't buy it, and so now they're both going to jail.
Well, and all of the bad press that it caused, too, for him.
Yeah, and now, mind you, this is the guy who ran for office on his pro-Christian family values kind of platform. Doesn't strike you as particularly recognizably pro-family or Christian, for that matter.
he's trying to ditch his wife.
Yeah, and so
throw her under the bus.
Yeah, exactly. And so now, you know, I'm never really a fan of prison rape jokes, but for a guy who wanted to legislatively mandate that thousands of Virginia women each year essentially be raped by the state, dude has it coming. Also in Virginia, unfortunately, Eric Cantor, the House Minority Leader Republican who was upset in a Tea Party primary earlier this year, actually resigned his seat rather than filling it out until November so he could cash in with his Wall Street buddies a few months early. And we found out this week the details of just how well he'll be able to cash in. Cantor is going to now get, before incentives, a $3.4 million a year base salary as a lobbyist for Moelis and Company. That's up from the $193,000 a year he earned as House Minority Whip. As Politico delicately put it, and Moelis in its own statement, that he's being rewarded for his efforts to lower taxes and, quote, eliminate excessive regulation. So if you ever wanted an example of how corruption works in the highest levels of American politics, this is a great example.
All right. Moving on to international, beginning with Israel expanding its holdings in the West Bank.
Yeah, this week the Israeli government claimed 1,000 acres of Palestinian land in the West Bank. That's land that's been owned for generations by Palestinian families. This, it turns out, is one of the largest single land grabs by the Israeli government since the 1980s. And it comes on the heels of the what's now being termed the 50-day war with Gaza. And many folks in the Israeli government view this land grab as just reparations for the kidnapping and killing of the three Israeli teenagers that happened earlier this year. But of course, Western governments and the U.S. government are making their unhappy noises about how that's a violation of international law to steal land from the Palestinians. But no one's really doing much about it.
Yeah, which is and of course, mind you, when Maria talks about being one of the largest since the 1980s, that is to say that this kind of land theft happens all the time. And we even hear it in the language where people are referred to as settlers as though there's nobody actually living on that land originally. No, they're not settling uninhabited land. They're grabbing land that belonged to other people.
All right. And new developments in Pakistan.
Yeah, a slow motion coup going on in Pakistan. There have been a long series of protests there led by a man who is an ex-athlete and appears to have military backing. Now, the person who is...
And who is a former prime minister himself.
Yes, and the person who is marshaling most of the protesters turns out is a cleric that has been living abroad as a Pakistani expatriate for many years, and he definitely seems to have a lot of backing from the military. Now, again, what this shows us is for one thing, one of the reasons why this protest is not bringing a lot of condemnation from the West, even though the current prime minister, who they're trying to unseat, was democratically elected in a landslide election not very long ago. The reason why this isn't bringing much attention from the West or from the U.S. government is because the current prime minister has been doing his best to try to undercut the military and try to get them under some kind of control. The military has pretty much controlled much of the politics of Pakistan for generations. The fact that they're orchestrating a slow motion coup should be of concern to the West, given our professed democratic values. But it's not, because, of course, this just kind of falls in line with some of the other governments that the U.S. supports in other parts of the world, say, for example, the government of Egypt, which has been also being run by the military currently.
Yeah, and one of the other issues, in addition to bringing the military under control, that the current Prime Minister Sharif has been trying to push, is that the military is very unhappy that he has been insisting on holding the former dictator Musharraf under house arrest and trying to prosecute him for some of his various corruptions and crimes during his period of being a military-backed dictator in Pakistan.
Musharraf actually seized power and unseated the current prime minister the last time he was elected.
Yes, with U.S. backing, we might add.
Yeah.
And so the fact that he's trying to hold Musharraf accountable is one of the reasons for his public support on the one hand, and one of the reasons for these military-backed protests and their efforts to unseat a democratically elected leader on the other. And particularly given that Pakistan is, in fact, unlike Iran, the Muslim country with a lot of extremists and nuclear weapons already in its possession, this should be something that's drawing a lot of attention in the West, but for some reason it's not.
All right. And just about a minute to talk about Libya.
Yeah. Some interesting developments in Libya in the last week or two. I think I talked last week or the week before about how Qatar is supporting one side of the Libyan civil war right now, the fundamentalist militants, and Egypt and the United Arab Emirates are supporting the other side, basically an ex-Qaddafi general who's trying to push the militias out of power. Because, of course, this week the militias first seized the airport in Tripoli, the country's main airport, and then they seized all of the capital of Tripoli, driving the current government out of power and unseating it. So right now things are deteriorating pretty quickly in Libya, and it's becoming one of the flashpoints in a regional war.
And in case this sounds vaguely familiar, U.S. goes in and orchestrates the removal and eventual death of a longtime dictator, but doesn't think through what kind of chaos it will unleash. Subsequently,
yes. Thank you, US and NATO.
Yeah, that should sound vaguely familiar. It's kind of becoming a theme in the region.
Uh-huh.
I think that's the lead template in their planning software. All right, events.
A number of them going on tomorrow from 2 to 7 p.m. This is actually a pretty big deal, a gathering to protect the sacredness of the Salish Sea, which is to say the inland waters of Strait of Georgia and Puget Sound, et cetera, from all fossil fuel threats. What this is, we've talked in past weeks about the Yakama Nation being one of the lead institutions that's challenging the coal terminal, export terminals, and coal and oil trains in the Northwest. And this is a new alliance that's being launched, the Nasamat Alliance, I think, is being launched between tribes, environmentalists, and other concerned parties to try and protect Puget Sound waters and the Pacific Northwest.
Similar to organizing that's happened in B.C.
Yes, very much so. So they're going to be doing a salmon bake and fundraiser and launch alliance. That is tomorrow from 2 to 7 o'clock. $20 is the suggested donation, though nobody will be turned away. It's at Daybreak Star Indian Cultural Center. It's got to be a warm, sunny day out in Discovery Park with salmon bacon. It ought to be great. A lot of good people, so go out there and check it out. On Tuesday.
Oh, can I just sure. Today is the Seattle Tilth Harvest Fair from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Meridian Park at 4649 Sunnyside Avenue North. So support Seattle Tilth and take your kids and have a good time.
Yeah, also a great day for doing something like that. And then on Tuesday, September 9th, from 7 to 9 p.m., Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Racism, Repression, and Resistance from Ferguson to Palestine will be an event at the Common Good Cafe as it resumes its fall program. That's at United University Temple, United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District. On Thursday, September 11th, 9/11, from 7:30 to 8:30, we'll be talking about a great catastrophe, but not the one you think. It's George Marshall talking about the psychology of climate change, which is to say why humans and especially governments and corporations are in denial about it and how to change that.
Yes, we need to get our head out of terrorism and into the real crisis.
Absolutely. So that'll be $5 at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca in downtown from 7:30 to 8:30 on Thursday. And then a couple events this coming Friday from 6:30 to 9, Community-Based Restorative Justice Network will be having a presentation with Dominic Barter that will be free at Campion Ballroom at Seattle University. There's also an all-day conference on restorative justice that'll be coming up a week from today on Saturday the 13th. On Friday the 12th, also from 7:30 to 10:30, Yes Magazine is hosting Tom Hartman in town for Money, Politics, and Saving Our Democracy. That will be $15 to $20 tickets at Town Hall, again, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle.